The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to top people and ideas. Presented by U-Mobile.
Good morning, I'm Melissa Idris and you're listening to The Breakfast Grill. Who controls corporate Malaysia? You'd be forgiven if you think it was the private sector that's driving corporate Malaysia. But it's not. Recent research by Professor Dr. Edmund Terence Gomez, Professor of Political Economy at University of Malaya, has found that control of the corporate sector is concentrated in the hands of the executive, specifically the Prime Minister, who's also the Finance Minister. And he's here today to discuss his latest book, Minister of Finance Incorporated, Ownership and Control of Corporate Malaysia. Professor Gomez, welcome to The Breakfast Grill. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you.
So this book is part of your ongoing research into the very complex web of control and ownership in the Malaysian economy. I think the best place to start is to lay the groundwork for the seven government-linked investment companies that you talk about in your book. Now, you've got Minister of Finance, Inc. right at the top, and then Khazanah Nasional, PNB, Permodalan Nasional, EPF, Kuap, LTAT and Lembaga Tabung Haji. These are seven GLICs that you focus on in the book. But these are not the only GLICs that operate in Malaysia.
The definition of a GLIC is that is one that was given by the government. We didn't define the GLICs.
And what is that definition?
The government decided when they were going to reform all the GLCs, they're going to identify a few of them as government-linked investment companies. And these are the seven institutions that they decided can be designated as GLICs. Of course, there are other institutions by their own definition, meaning they are investment holding companies, they have interest in a lot of publicly listed companies, they are major savings funds. There can be other GLICs too. For example, Soxo could be a GLIC. One can see even Petronas can be a GLIC.
So why did you decide not to focus on Petronas and Soxo?
Because there would then have been a big argument as to why we left out some and included others. So we decided we will go by the government's definition and we will do the study based on who the government identified as GLICs.
So are all GLICs created equal in the seven that you've listed in your book?
No, they're extremely different. MOF Inc. is an investment holding company under the Ministry of Finance. If you look at PNB, KWOP, LTAT, LTH, they are savings institutions. They are companies or institutions in which a lot of private savings goes into them. That's why they are cash rich. And then we have a sovereign wealth fund, and that would be Khazanah. So they are different.
And what is the difference between a GLIC and a GLC, a government-linked investment company and a government-linked company? Because I think often we kind of lump them into one. Is that a fair assessment to make?
That's how they're normally seen. In fact, when we did the study, I was shocked in the early stages when I spoke to people about the GLICs. No one knew there was such a thing as a GLIC. All they knew was that there were many GLCs, government-linked companies. So here's the difference. A GLIC is an investment holding institution. They own a lot of GLCs. So who owns the GLICs? All of them come under the Minister of Finance Incorporated.
I'm speaking to Professor Gomez about his recent book, Minister of Finance Incorporated. Now, Professor Gomez, let's just stay on the definitions. When we want to get the terminology correct and the definitions correct, you've got GLICs, government-linked investment companies, government-linked companies, GLCs, and then state-owned enterprises, SOEs. How does that come into play?
Well, to tell you the truth, we didn't want to use the word SOEs because it's a term actually that is used in many countries. If you look at China and if you look at most countries around the world, if they have investment holding companies, they are called SOEs. Malaysia and Singapore are probably the only two countries that use the term GLCs. But having said that, let me say this. There are a lot of different types of companies which are designated as GLCs. A statutory body is a GLC. A statutory body means it's a company established by law. Then we have holding companies. Then we have lembagas. And then we have yayasans. They all come under this broad thing that we call GLCs. So what we need to do now is break down all these GLCs, and that's the next stage of the study that we are doing.
Okay, so we'll stay on the first stage, which is looking at the seven GLICs at the moment. Where does 1MDB sit in the structure of GLICs and GLCs and SOEs?
1MDB is a investment holding company. It was also supposed to function like a sovereign wealth fund. That comes separate. It was created separately. It doesn't fall under the GLICs. And later, after the problems with 1MDB occurred, it came under the control of MOF Inc.
So now, would it be characterized as GLIC, given that most of the GLICs are under the control of MOF Inc.?
Not by the government's definition. It would be characterized as a GLC.
Okay. Coming back to MOF Inc., Minister of Finance Incorporated, you, in your research, called Minister of Finance Inc. the super entity, a super entity in the economy because of its unprecedented concentration of power in the executive. The simple question would be, how did it come into existence?
MOF Inc. was established at the time of independence in 1957.
Why? Why was there a need for an MOF Inc.?
The government was going to take over assets owned by the colonial government. The newly independent government was going to take over assets of the colonial government. Mm-hmm. So they created this company called MOF Inc., which is a holding company under the Ministry of Finance, to hold all these assets that they had taken over from the colonial government. That was its function. It was supposed to act as a holding company. It could operate as a company. But let me be very clear about MOF Inc. It has no board of directors. It is just a division within the Ministry of Finance. In that sense, it doesn't operate like a proper company. It's a holding company for the assets of the state.
And the person in charge of MOF Inc. is the Minister of Finance?
That's right.
Also the Prime Minister?
That's right.
There's one at every state level as well, right? Because there's also state GLICs as well. You see Menteri Besar Incorporated, for instance. Is that a trickle down from the federal government?
Let me say this. We have now just embarked on the second stage of our study, where we are looking at all 13 state governments. Not all state governments have what you called the Menteri Besar Incorporated. Mm-hmm. In fact, that's a new construct in some states. They have what is known as the SEDCs, the State Economic Development Corporations. They were created to hold assets of the state.
Can I come back very quickly to what you said, that we've had an MOF Inc. since the beginning of independence, and that was because we needed to
yes.
take over the assets from the British. But it's been 60 years now since independence. What is the purpose of MOF Inc. decades post-independence?
The book has a long history about these companies. We decided to provide some history here because how MOF Inc. operated depended on who was the Prime Minister. So under Tunku Abdul Rahman, it operated as a holding company, holding the assets taken over from the colonial government. That was the structure also, I would argue, under Tun Abdul Razak and Tun Hussein Onn. In Mahathir's time, there was a shift. They decided that they could transfer some of these assets to other places, for example, Khazana. Khazana was supposed to play the role of MOF Inc., take over these assets and use these assets in a very productive way. Khazana was supposed to be a sovereign wealth fund, and the sovereign wealth fund was supposed to play this role of how do we utilize these assets controlled by the state in a manner in which they bring back greater returns. So it depends on the Prime Minister. If you come to the case of Tun Abdullah instituted some reforms. It was called the GLC Transformation Program. This was a major program because when Tun Abdullah took power, he realized that the GLCs and the GLICs were key players. And he said, let's have a major reform of these companies. And then we have the current Prime Minister, Najib Razak. Najib Razak basically continued what Tun Abdullah did because it was a 10-year plan to reform the GLCs. But you can see here that there's been a lot of shifting of assets. MOF Inc. was not supposed to play this role after the formation of Khazana. And it, in fact, transferred many of these assets to Khazana, for example. But there's now been a shifting back of assets back into MOF Inc. And if you look at the assets owned by MOF Inc., they own Khazana, they own PNB. But they also own some rather unique companies, such as the National Feedlot Corporation, which was involved in a major scandal. They own 1MDB, which was also involved in a major scandal. They own assets which were once owned by UMNO. UMNO was a party, was a party that was deeply involved in business. So one company, for example, which is directly under MOF Inc. is KUB. KUB is the cooperative created for UMNO members, Koperasi Usaha Bersatu. That's also there. So you can see here the shifting of assets from different key actors in the economy into the hands of MOF Inc.
And when did this shift start to happen?
That we can't be sure because, again, the thing that we realized when we looked at these GLICs is that they can be a tool for political interests. They can be a tool to solve problems in the economy linked to key actors within the political system.
I'm speaking to Professor Dr. Edmund Terence Gomez, Professor of Political Economy at University of Malaya, and we're talking about his recent book, Minister of Finance Incorporated. After this, how the different prime ministers have employed GLICs during their administration. Stay tuned right here on The Morning Run, BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U-Mobile.
Good morning, this is The Breakfast Grill, and with me is University of Malaya academic Professor Dr. Edmund Terence Gomez. He's the author of Minister of Finance Incorporated, which is a look at the omnipresent control of government-linked investment companies. Now, Professor Gomez, just before the break, we were talking about how different prime ministers handle GLICs differently. One of the things that struck me the most was after GE 13, when Prime Minister Najib announced the Bumiputra Economic Empowerment Program, the BEE. And at that point in time, he instructed GLICs and GLCs to play a lead role in the implementation of this Bumiputra Empowerment Policy. Enterprises would now have a political agenda to get Bumiputra support for the ruling party. Was that an important milestone to pay attention to?
It was a major shift in public policy. When Najib came to power, it was at a time of a global financial crisis. And in that period, 2008-2009, there was a lot of discussions about how to reform the economy. There was talk about a new economic model. I would argue that at that time, he spoke to many people in the corporate sector and they advised him to review the government's policy on affirmative action in business. It was just not inspiring confidence among domestic investors. Mm-hmm. And it had not played the role it was supposed to play, specifically to create a new breed of Bumiputra corporate captains. So Najib announced, subsequently, no more affirmative action. It was headlines in the newspapers. And then there was a backlash from right-wing groups, including former Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad. And Najib backtracked, and he introduced what was called the market-friendly affirmative action. It was to pacify dissidents within the state, within UMNO too, I would argue. If you read the 10th Malaysia Plan, there's a mention of the market-friendly affirmative action and what it's supposed to do. If you read the 11th Malaysia Plan, there's absolutely no mention of or review of market-friendly affirmative action. It was a tacit admission that the policy was just not working. That is why in 2013, this was an epochal event. In 2013, the Barisan Nasional did not do well in the elections. And in that election too, the Najib clearly blamed the non-Bumiputra, specifically the Chinese, for not voting for the Barisan Nasional. The Barisan Nasional lost the popular vote in that election. In that environment, 5 months later, he comes up with the Bumiputra Economic Empowerment Policy. Mm. Now, this is a major shift in public policy. I would argue even the Prime Minister should have known better because he himself admitted the policy was not working before. But he went on to say to implement the BEE, he would get the GLICs and the GLCs to do it. By his own admission, he said it. So I think that this is not a good move on the part of the Prime Minister. What he should have done was to review affirmative action in business, ask why it had not worked well. None of these questions were asked. And instead, I would argue now what we are seeing is the use of the GLICs and GLCs as a tool to muster political support.
Which makes me ask the question, what is the mandate of a GLIC? Is it to make as much money as possible for the government to invest in development of the country? Or does it have a certain social agenda?
The GLICs have to do both. That's the interesting point about the GLICs. They have an economic agenda and they have a social agenda. For example, PNB. PNB's mandate is to invest in assets with money from Apna Saham National, for example. And these investments are supposed to create dividends, which will then go back to the Apna Saham dividends. Mm-hmm. And as you know, and I must stress this point, Apna Saham National has been declaring huge dividends. Now, the only way they can declare huge dividends is if the GLCs are well run. We argue in the book that the GLCs are quite well run. They are led by professionals, and these professionals know how to run these companies, and so they declare high revenues, which also then translate into high dividends.
So you're saying that despite this dual mandate of social and economic objectives, that they're achieving both?
What I'm saying is that if we leave the GLICs and GLCs alone, to be run by professionals without any political interference, they can be well run. And they have shown that to be the case.
Well, you've actually found in your research that there are more bureaucrats and technocrats running the GLCs and GLICs as opposed to 20 years ago where there were UMNO politicians and UMNO linked proxies being appointed to the boards of these companies.
My most significant finding is that these GLICs and GLCs are now being run by what I call professionals, corporate professionals, people who are well-trained in their respective disciplines. They are turnaround experts. They've been brought in during the GLC transformation program to run these companies well. Many of these GLCs were originally owned by the state, then privatized or ran aground, had to be bailed out during 1997. These corporate professionals were brought in and they turned around these companies. Many of these companies, as I said, are well-functioning companies.
So the performance of GLCs, GLICs, they're doing well. They're run well and they're doing well. So the issue that you brought up in your book is the issue of control.
That's right.
But control is a very dicey term. You have to define control well. How do you do it?
In our book, we were not too interested in the concept of ownership.
So not about equity shareholding.
It's about control. Control can come in many forms, as we show, through legislation, through the use of majority control, through the use of golden shares. What we also showed was, if you look at the control patterns, there's a pyramiding system which goes back to the super entity, which is Minister of Finance Incorporated. What that means is, the people who are appointed as directors are also very important, because all those people appointed as directors are by the Minister of Finance. Now, here's the problem. If you have directors who are directly accountable to the Minister of Finance, they owe the appointments to him, the Minister of Finance can also dictate through them, when he wants, how some of these companies can be run. So, for example, we found cases where certain GLICs were employed to take over assets linked to 1MDB. We have found through the BEE. Now, the BEE, it's explicit. The BEE will be implemented by the GLICs and the GLCs. So here's where we need to make a clear distinction. While the professionals may be professional, know what to do, and can do it well, they can also be subservient to the state. Now, that raises a red flag. If these GLICs can be used to bail out or deal with companies which are involved in serious issues, huge debts, what does this say about the checks and balances within the system?
I guess also, you know, when I was thinking about the issue of control and the way you laid it out in your book, the question comes back to, is it a necessary evil to have some measure of control? Granted, maybe not the kind of heavy-handed control that you cite in your book, but is it necessary for some measure of government control in markets to protect a national agenda?
Yes. There is a necessity for it. But what we are talking about here is who ultimately has control over all these companies. Ultimately, who are these people accountable to? Are there checks and balances in the system? One of the reforms that we suggested was that these GLICs and GLCs, since they are such huge players in the economy, they should be accountable to Parliament. And here we also argued we should create select committees which will have oversight over the GLCs. The select committees also should be led by members of the opposition. Now, what I'm proposing may seem very idealistic, but if you go to other countries, like, say, for example, if you go to Britain, you will find that this is the case. They do have select committees led by the opposition, which has oversight over key issues, so that this can be a check on the government too.
What do you think about the current level of transparency with GLICs and GLCs? How difficult was that to do research if you didn't have access to that information?
The companies that we studied, the GLCs, are all publicly listed. And we looked only at the top 100. So we found 35 of them. If you look at institutions such as the Bursa and the Securities Commission, right, I would argue that they are quite well run. They are manned by highly competent people. I would argue that some of the reforms under the GLC transformation program are among the best I've seen. OECD claims that Malaysia went very far in these reforms and they put it up as a model for many countries to study. But here's the problem. Selective prosecution can also occur. If these institutions are ultimately responsible to the Minister of Finance again, And if the Minister of Finance has some kind of leverage over these institutions, then we have this problem, as I said, of selective patronage. Some people may be prosecuted, and the SC and the Bursa will be allowed to do their work. And in other cases, they may not. Some deals may be allowed to go through. Other deals may not be allowed to go through. So this is the problem that we are having. Is there sufficient devolution of power to all these institutions? Another major recommendation we had was we need to create autonomous oversight institutions. They cannot be responsible or under the ambit of the Prime Minister or the Minister of Finance.
But there was also a big push for divestment. There was a big push to reduce the role of government in the private sector. Well, what do you think about those efforts so far?
One of the other reforms that Najib talked about when he came to power was this. His words were these: the government has no business being in business. He was quoting politicians such as Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan. And he said, we have to get the government out of business. And he advocated privatization. But about a year later, when we were doing the study, we realized all discussions on privatization came to an end. I think Najib may have realized that he was sitting on a gold mine here with a lot of companies under his control. One of the other things that Najib also announced was that we should make the private sector the engine of growth. And if there are dynamic companies, let them be, support them. Another finding that we found in our study was that the government had actually begun to take over companies, particularly in construction. So you will see here companies such as SP Satir, UEM Sunrise,
yep.
Sunrise, IJM, Gamuda.
Why? Why construction?
That's the question that we asked ourselves too. And then we realized that if you look at UMNO politics, you will find that UMNO now has a lot of business people in the party, and many of them are in construction. If you look at a Class F, Class G, at the grassroots level, many of them are in construction. Our interpretation of these events is that by taking over construction companies, especially major construction companies, it becomes an avenue through which you can also practice patronage through subcontracting. You will also remember that Najib has become a prime minister who is extremely involved or concerned about infrastructure development, and we've seen a lot of construction projects, major construction projects being implemented.
It seems to me, Professor Gomez, that the trajectory of the involvement of GLICs in the economy seems to mirror the evolution of the ruling party, the changes within UMNO itself.
My concern is of late there seems to be a political turn rather than a bureaucratic turn or social turn within the GLCs. By that I mean, while there has been a removal of UMNO members as directors and even as owners of publicly listed companies, all this power now is concentrated in the office of the Minister of Finance himself. So one man has become extremely powerful. This is a significant shift from UMNO being a key player and UMNO members being a key player in the corporate sector to just the Prime Minister.
What does that tell you?
Concentration of political power in the office of the Prime Minister and the Minister of Finance.
What does that tell you about party politics within UMNO?
The thing which concerned me about this is this. I really do wonder how many UMNO members are aware of this significant shift that we have seen in the corporate sector. This has been a gradual shift. UMNO members do complain if you go to the General Assembly. They do complain they don't have enough say in the GLCs. They don't have enough presence in the GLCs. But do they really understand the significant shift in terms of moving out UMNO members from publicly listed companies as well as from the GLICs, except for one GLIC? There's only one GLIC where UMNO members appear very prominently, hold major positions there, and that's Tabung Haji.
Tabung Haji, which has been rife with scandals and mismanagement of funds. So Tabung Haji is the only GLIC of the seven that you're looking at that's still run by politicians?
That is directly run by politicians. And this is a big concern because, as you can see now, when politicians are involved, you get scandals. I must say that in Khazana 2, the chairman is the prime minister. And we have
board of directors as well, ministers on the board of directors.
Yes, but they are there by virtue of the ministerial positions they hold in cabinet, not because they happen to be UMNO members.
I'm speaking to Professor Dr. Edmund Terence Gomez, Professor of Political Economy at University of Malaya, about his recent book, Minister of Finance Incorporated. After the news, we'll come back with Professor Gomez with an extended breakfast grill, and we're going to be talking about how to reduce the concentration of power in the executive. Stay with us here on BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U-Mobile.
Good morning. Welcome back to The Breakfast Grill. With me is Professor Dr. Edmund Terence Gomez this morning, and we're talking about his recent book, Minister of Finance Incorporated. Now, before the news bulletin, we were talking about the shift of GLICs and GLCs and how they've been run. According to your research, Professor Gomez, you had found that there's been a shift from politicians to professionals. So talk to me a bit about that trend, about when that shift started to happen and the implications of it.
When Mahathir Mohamad came to power, one of the major issues on his mind was how to create a Bumiputra corporate captains community. And he went about doing it, and he used policies such as the affirmative action in business policy, as well as privatization. By 1996, a new breed of Bumiputra corporate captains had emerged: Halim Saad, Tajuddin Ramli, Wan Azmi, Wan Hamzah. But what is interesting about that new breed of corporate captains is this. One group of them were linked to the Prime Minister and then Finance Minister Dame Zainuddin. And they were professionals too. It was hard to see whether they were running these companies on their own or whether they were also accountable to the Prime Minister, Mahathir, and Dame Zainuddin. But there was another group of businessmen who were politicians in UMNO. And these businessmen come politicians, UMNO members, were linked to then Finance Minister Anwar Ibrahim. So we had two sets of business people. And that meant there were different warlords in the party who had significant ownership of corporate assets. It also meant that UMNO members could go to these warlords as a means to secure patronage, including money. And money became a big issue in UMNO politics at that time. Everything fell apart in 1997. First, we had the currency crisis, and then we had the fallout between Mahathir and Anwar. When the currency crisis occurred, many of these companies had to be bailed out. And that's when the GLICs and GLCs came into the picture. And the GLCs were then used to take over all these companies. And suddenly, there was a massive number of GLCs under the control of the government.
All right.
In 2001, Mahathir also decided that he's going to make himself finance minister.
This was just after he had a falling out with Tun Dame Zainuddin.
That's right. First, he had a fallout with Anwar, and then he had a fallout with Dame. So finally, he decided, I'm going to be the finance minister. He appointed Noor Mohammad Yaqob, former deputy bank Negara governor, as his economic advisor. And Noor Mohammad advised Mahathir that since he had control over such a huge number of companies, and some of them are major companies, including in construction and media, he said these companies had to be turned around. And it was Noor Mohammad who brought in all these young, bright men, turnaround experts, as he called them, and they helped him to turn around these companies. These companies were turned around and became well-running companies. MRCB today, for example, is a major company. There's another company called Media Prima. Media Prima is a company which holds all the major media companies, including NST and TV3, Berita Harian. So there was a major revamp of all these companies which were once linked to UMNO politicians. The GLC transformation program that Abdullah introduced was significant because he realized he had to revamp these companies and make sure they are run well. That's when the consolidation of the professionals came into play. One of the things of the GLC transformation program was Abdullah also decided to remove politicians as board of directors.
Right. I'd like to end, Professor Gomez, on kind of a look forward. So in your book, you outlined some proposed reforms to reduce the concentration of power in the finance ministry. And you've alluded to them throughout this interview. But if you could just kind of list them out, very simple, straightforward reforms of how you think we could go about reversing the concentration of power in MOF Inc.
The most interesting thing from this study is this. When we were talking about reforms, we felt some of the most fundamental reforms can be done immediately. The first reform, of course, is that the Prime Minister cannot hold the position of Minister of Finance. he has to relinquish that position. So there's a check and balance in cabinet too between the Prime Minister
and the
Minister.
And you say this is the simplest and easiest to implement?
It can be done tomorrow if the Prime Minister decides so.
With the consent of the Prime Minister, of course. In the corporate sector, the CEO is never the same person as the CFO. That's just good corporate governance. But the justification Tun Mahathir had when he made the move to consolidate the office of the Prime Minister and the office of the Finance Minister was, he said, well, you know, the Prime Minister has a responsibility to stabilize the economy, has oversight over the economy. And that, again, kind of ties back to the national agenda.
Yes.
What are your comments on that?
That may be true, although I won't buy that argument. I would argue that the reason why Mahathir took over the position of Minister of Finance is because he had a serious fallout with Dime Zainuddin. And this is mentioned in the book, that fallout emerged because of his decision to consolidate the banking sector. That was an epochal moment in Malaysian history. And in that attempt to consolidate the banking sector, a feud emerged between Mahathir's sons, Mukhzani in particular, and Dime Zainuddin. These are facts. And it was those issues that led to the consolidation of the position between Minister of Finance and the Prime Minister. So I want to put that in context too, you know, the difference between the rhetoric and the reality of politics that was going on at that time. I would have thought that Abdullah, with all the reforms that he introduced, would have done that. There was no need for Abdullah to hold on to the position of Minister of Finance, but he did so. I would argue that he held on to that position because the Minister of Finance is such a powerful portfolio. And UMNO is a party of patronage and money. And it's too important a portfolio to relinquish. And Abdullah wasn't really that strong when he came to power too. So politics has also dictated who remains as Minister of Finance. I would argue that Najib also recognized that and decided to hold on to the portfolio.
Yeah, that proposal was also to leave the professional managers of the GLICs and GLCs to leave them be, let them run the companies with autonomy.
They must be accountable to the board of directors. So here, the board of directors, how we appoint them is also very important. There must be good oversight over these appointments, and they must be competent people.
Have you gotten any response from these proposals, from these proposed reforms?
No, I have not got even one response on this. I don't think there's political will for these kinds of reforms.
Have you had any response from the book? I mean, it's been out for about a month and a half now. Have you heard back any feedback, any responses from the people involved in, you know, the subject matter of your book?
Not one.
Do you know if the finance minister has read it?
I have no idea. I hope he has.
Okay. Well, what's next for you, Professor Gomez? What do you do now with the research? Because if I understand correctly, this is perhaps the first round. There's going to be more rounds, perhaps?
The big issue here is to what extent should the government intervene in the economy? That's a big debate we've been having in our country, and it's a debate we need to have. So what we're doing is this. Before we get into the debate, let's look first at the extent to which the government is involved in the economy. We have only done 7 GLICs and 35 GLCs for this book. We have now gone to the second stage where I have one student who is looking at all publicly listed companies, all 904 of them, and we have identified about more than 100 that can be classified as GLCs. I have another student who's looking at all 13 states, and we are looking at GLCs that are controlled by the respective state governments. That's also very interesting because at least 5 of the states are controlled by different parties. Right. DAP has control over Penang, PAS has control over Kelantan, PKR has control over Selangor, and PBB has control over Sarawak. So this is very interesting. How do these different parties own and control these companies? That's going to be an interesting study. We've also found that all 24 ministries under the government own businesses. So we are looking at all the companies owned by under the respective ministries. Why should ministries also have ownership and control of GLCs? That's another stage of the research that we are looking at. And I'm hoping we can finish these 3 studies by next year. This should be an important output too, because it speaks to the larger question. We need to get this economy back on track, to be well-functioning. What is the role of the state? To what extent should it intervene in the economy? What is the role of the private sector too? How do we nurture dynamic SMEs in particular?
Well, it sounds like you have a mammoth task ahead of you, but one that is important for all informed citizens to take note of. It's been a pleasure having you here, Professor Gomez. Thank you so much for spending time with us this morning on The Breakfast Grill.
Thank you.
That was Professor Dr. Edmund Terence Gomez, Professor of Political Economy at University Malaya, speaking about his recent book, Minister of Finance Incorporated, Ownership and Control of Corporate Malaysia. I'm Melissa Idris, and you've been listening to The Breakfast Grill on BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
That episode of BFM Breakfast Grill was brought to you by U-Mobile, where data hearts you.